So tonight I'd like to talk to you about generosity. It's kind of that time of year, and it's the first paramita, one of the first perfections. And I'd like to start with inner generosity. Meditation for me is a perfect way to work on inner generosity. When we first start meditation, more traditionally, we're taught just to notice thinking and come back to the breath, because we need to settle down, stabilize ourselves, have a little less chaos in our system. And that may take a few months or a few years, a few short years, depending on our situation. And it's not that we ever sort of achieve equanimity all the time, and we can settle ourselves down a bit. Then it seems an important thing to be able to befriend our thoughts. How do I start to recognize my thinking? Maybe even label the thoughts. Some of the traditional labels are judging, planning, what they call desiring, they call fearing, and one I rarely do, which is commenting, because I'm usually judging. I've noticed that my top two are planning and judging.
Perennial favorites.
And by noticing them in the mindfulness practice, it alerts me to when I'm doing it out in the world, and I can often catch myself and make a choice. I sometimes say, and it was absolutely true, before I started mindfulness, I never thought I was judgmental, I just thought I was right.
Wrong.
Yeah, I thought I was right. And then I was quite horrified, actually, in my first few retreats to see the level of judgmentalness. But over time, working with it, I've been able to befriend my judgments, because I recognize that they're trying to keep me safe. They're actually just trying to make me feel right, and if I'm right, I can feel secure. It's not very skillful, but it was my strategy when I was young. And so I think the idea that we can start to recognize some of our thoughts, especially the pervasive ones, the ones that keep coming up again, and find a way to hold them with compassion. The idea of generosity is that we're a good host, that we would really be kind to what comes into our head. And we could have a sense of hospitality, actually. The thoughts could be thought of as the customer. And how do we, in some ways, not kick the customer out of our habitat? But how do we integrate it? How do we accept it and be compassionate for those thoughts? And if I can, I realize that they can actually start to become the basis of my wisdom and compassion. Because I've noticed how judgmental I am. And I've done some examining, and I see I'm judgmental because I'm trying to be safe. And so I could appreciate them, the judgmentalness, without getting caught in it. That's the trick. And some way to bring myself back is to use a concentration. So breath is a classic one. Loving kindness is a good one. Any concentration that helps us stabilize, a focusing device, that's a way to break the spell of the sort of thought that starts to create the story. It suddenly becomes an IMAX theater. You have a big sound system, a big screen, visceral responses. So I need, it's a tricky thing to be generous and hospitable to those thoughts. And I think it's important. Because if we can be generous to that part of ourself, we could relax with it a little bit, instead of trying to transform it or get rid of it or ignore it, which takes a fair amount of energy, actually, to constantly push that away. Instead of the generosity to host the thoughts, using awareness to catch it before it starts to spin too far, and recovering our sense of generous hospitality to whatever arises. So it's a little bit of a fine line of when am I indulging and when am I pushing away. When can I accept? And the acceptance may be a few seconds, it may be a few minutes. If we're paying attention, we can start to tell when we're on that edge of indulging. And for me, indulging means that I start to repeat myself. I start hearing the same thing over and over. That means, okay, I'm starting to be caught in the loop. And I can use one of the concentrations to shift and take me back. And if we can be open to that, as they say, everything arises, abides, and dissolves. Some dissolve more easily than others. We understand the truth of impermanence. That's what's really a great gift. Because if the thought comes up, and I can either allow it to dissolve or I could use a concentration to reorganize myself, I realize that it doesn't last. Nothing lasts. Everything will go. Unless you're Egyptian, you don't get to take any of it with you. And so, recognizing that with especially these particularly pervasive thoughts, minor, as I said, judging and planning. Actually, the first 25 years of my practice, judging was primary, planning underneath it. And then about 20 years ago, it's shifted, and planning has become primary and judging is right underneath it. They traded places, but they're still very close and quite familiar to me. So, if we can see those thoughts as maybe a child, because usually they were developed when we were children as ways of trying to keep ourselves safe, those patterns of thinking, then we could be a little more kind, the way ideally good parenting, we may not like what the child does, and we commit to loving the child. And so if we can love that part of ourselves, then we're being generous. At the same time, we don't want to let the child just throw the tantrum. There needs to be some containment and some working with that so we can find more equanimity in moments of our life. So I think once we can have a little sense of generosity with ourselves, which is where we need to start, then we can start to think about what's it like to be generous with others. The power of generosity is very magnetic. It creates a sense of reciprocity. If someone is generous to us, we naturally tend to want to be generous back. And because of mirror neurons and limbic resonance, it's not just an idea, but it's a felt sense that happens. When someone is warm and open and generous and caring, it sort of activates our sense of warmth and openness and generosity and caring. And so it creates a sort of positive cycle. And I think it's important these days because there's a lot of concern and negative energy, and especially we get pulled into our devices or the news, and then there's a tightening that goes along with that, and when we tighten up, we release cortisol in our system. And the cortisol makes us feel more separate. It shuts down the sense of connectedness. And so, if we could make more of a commitment to work with generosity, and one way to do it, I always like questions. When I make assertions, I'm anti-authoritarian even to myself. Like, you are generous, and you will be generous, and then immediately I backfire on myself and think, you're never generous, you're always selfish. But if I ask a question, it's a great way to sneak up on myself. So I might say, what would it be like if there was just a little more generosity in this moment, and let myself wonder a bit. And when I do that, there's a little bit of connecting, openness. So I invite you to explore the idea of asking yourself a question. And I also know from the work that I do and research that if the change is too big or too much, the limbic system will rebel against it. That we do better when we change in small increments. And I always say if they raise taxes 3%, we all freak out. But often, if we change 3%, we don't think very much of it. But 3% would actually be a big change. So what if there was a little more generosity? That I don't feel that I suddenly have to become super generous in my system reacting to that. Instead, a little more generosity feels much more workable. And another way that I can work with generosity is to think who, and I'm going to use famous ones, and you know me, those of you who've heard me before, I work with archetypes. Who represents somebody who's very generous? And I immediately go to Mother Teresa and the Dalai Lama and my teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, Tibetan teacher, because my experience of those people was an amazing sense of generosity. And it's not just a concept, it's more of a felt sense in my body. So if I think of His Holiness, immediately I feel a little bit of warmth and a smile comes over my face and I feel that I want to be helpful. Or Mother Teresa. She's a great help for me because I tend to be quite reactive, especially driving. And so I do react initially, but right behind that, if I can think of Mother Teresa, it totally shifts it for me. I shift from, you're an idiot, to, oh, be careful. So the idea of using archetypes doesn't have to be people. I'm an avid gardener, and I sometimes think how generous the earth is. When you add compost, which, by the way, is shit, and we have plenty of that. it enriches the soil. And then wonderful things grow. The earth is very generous at producing fruit and flowers and vegetables. So it could be something that we could all cultivate in terms of wondering, what if there was a little more of it? Where does it show up for me? Who represents it? And that's a way we could get into the territory of generosity. And then, just as in meditation, just because I've achieved a moment of equanimity and I've balanced doesn't mean it lasts. Even within that very sit, I could just take a plunge down into a whole chaotic moment of judging and planning and this and that and the other. Or if I have a great sit, the next day I could have a not-so-great sit. So it's not that it always builds toward that, but that it's a continual effort and that we find a way to inspire us, to motivate ourselves. So we can think of the inspirational energies as our Sangha, not just this particular Sangha or the larger Sangha in the Bay Area, but there's a universal Sangha. People all over the world, in all countries, who are doing unbelievably generous things for each other. And we could think about that and connect with it and feel that we're part of something much bigger. Because when we feel we're connected, then we don't feel so needy. When we feel separate, when we get that cortisol running through us, when we get irritated, when we get anxious, we tighten up, we separate, and then we need to try to figure out what we're going to do to create safety, to create security. So by lightening up, by opening up a little bit, inviting generosity, I start feeling, in a funny way, a little more secure. I feel like I'm connected. I'm not completely alone. And I have support. Whether it's the experience of a wind at my back, or people with their hands on my back, people who care about me, who want to support me. That memory that we're connected allows me to be more generous. I'm going to stop here for a moment and see if there's any comments or questions. Yes.
Cortisol response. I was quite active in the midterm elections because I felt I needed to be. So I was paying a lot of attention to the news. And I guess I'm just exploring, is there a way to do that and be informed and be active without kind of triggering that whole cascade of stuff?
That's a very good question. And for people who are active, it is a line to tread, for sure. some of you have heard me talk about this, but I'll speak about it again. I'm a doubter by nature, and so when something arises in front of me, my first response is, I can't do it, or it's not going to work. And then I use that to invite what I euphemistically call my posse, or the inspirational characters. So I invite the wisdom of the Dalai Lama, compassion of Mother Teresa, and the confidence of either the founder of Aikido or Nelson Mandela. These are all energies that I'm very connected to. And so I get the sense that I don't have to do it, but it can come through me. So if it's coming through me, I don't have to self-generate. And if I don't have to self-generate, then I don't have to worry about success or failure. So the whole idea of being engaged in things that are challenging or even negative, I always think it's too much for me, Wendy. It's not too much for these archetypes, because they face things equally challenging. And plus, it's not just one, I've got a posse, is how I look at it. And so it's the attitude that I'm part of something much bigger and I'm going to invite it to come through me. The way, the principle is what we did a little bit with the wind when we were walking, or the wind lifting your arms up. That there is, I believe, the universe has a benevolent energy that wants to help us. But because of our educational system, we were taught, you must do it, no one will do it for you, you're responsible, you have to do it. And most of us bought that. We weren't told there's huge resources all around us, there's support everywhere. We weren't told that. So if we can get in the habit of, especially when we're facing something really challenging like that, instead of, I have to do this, I think I had the intention to do it. Of course, I need to self-generate the intention. I want to go out there and make a difference. In terms of doing the actual actions, I always think, okay, Mother, help me. Okay, Your Holiness, come through me. And it really takes the pressure off me feeling that I'm going to fail or that I'm in danger. It puts me in a very resourceful state of being. Does that make sense? Especially when you're doing work, that the kind of work you're speaking of, where you're up against lots of moving pieces and lots of intensity and lots of negativity. It's a percentage game. So on a scale of 1 to 100, how big was the challenge you were facing? And then you're going to need to rally, let's say there was an 85, you're going to need to rally 90 watts of inspiration to match it. Yeah, we always say the one with the most juice wins. And size matters. We've seen it in a negative way in this country, but you can see it in a positive way too. Not the size of your bicep, but the size of your spirit. When you're big, you get recognized. You have a voice. Doesn't mean people like you or agree with you, and you will have a voice if you have size. If you make yourself small, and we do that for very good reasons, people's bodies can't feel you. And if they can't feel you, you don't really exist. So you don't have a voice. You could be the smartest person in the room, but if limbically, if energetically, I'm sure we've all had the experience of somebody walks in the room and you go, whoa, you felt their energy, either positively or negatively, because that made an impact. So each of us, especially if we want to make a contribution, whether it's political or otherwise, if you want to do that, we have to do the hard work of becoming bigger. And when we become bigger, we become more visible. When we become more visible, people will project onto us. That's the price we pay for being able to make a difference. Projections. But it's really important. There's kind of a bigness behind me here. Right? And even when you see the depictions of the Buddha like this or something, for me, I never see this feeling in any depiction of the Buddha, that little bit of shrinking. There's always a sense of presence emanating out. It's one of the reasons why during the movement exercise, I'm working on helping us find ways to be lighter, bigger, more open. It means we'll have a voice. And I think, especially people who are in a committed sangha, it's important that we do have a voice. Because we have really good energy we can draw on to go out there and do whatever we need to do in the world to be helpful, to contribute. Does that help? Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Or comments? Yes.
Could you say a little more about how you use concentration to find equanimity when you're challenged?
Yes.
So
I make a distinction between concentration and awareness. So awareness notices what is. I become aware that I'm judging. And then if I'm not careful with my background, I'll think, oh God, I'm judging again. I'm a terrible person. I've been judging for 72 years. Jesus, is this ever going to end? So I'll start a big thing with it. But that's because awareness opened that door. So I must be careful that I don't allow that door that's opened with awareness to spin me into a story that's going to be unskillful. Concentration, now focusing on breath is a concentration. Concentration is where you put your attention on a specific reference so that the mind doesn't go anywhere else. So the breath is the most classic. I personally, like some of you who've heard me before, a posture, a sense of a lightness, strong back and a gentle front. That's a concentration I work on. A way of being, a sense of openness. You could do a visualization as a concentration. A still pool with the moon reflecting in it. There's a wonderful concentration that I use quite often. It's from a Tibetan practice, and it's very long and involved, and I try to take it and make it pithy. And the pithy version is asking myself, if my hips were like a mountain, and I invite my favorite mountain into my hips, and then I can stay with that for 10 or 20 seconds if I'm on it. And then I go to my heart, and I say, if my heart was like the ocean or like water, and then I invite my favorite moment of water into my heart. And again, I can stay with that for 10, maybe 20 seconds. And then I go to my head and I ask if my mind was like the sky. And I use the night sky these days because I think the stars are cool. And if I'm lucky, I can stay with that. So that could actually give me almost a full minute of reprieve from the story, as it were. So that's what I mean by concentration. You put your mind in a particular focusing. I had an Indian teacher once who said that mantra, and by that he meant concentration, not just words, protects the mind from itself. Mantra. That just means, in this context, concentration, not, it could be visual, protects the mind from itself. Now, the tricky part is if I do primarily concentration, in other words, if I always come back to my breath, always come back to my breath, I don't get a chance to examine my thoughts and make friends with my thoughts or feelings. So we one-way approach is to start with the shamatha, the coming back to your breath, and do that for a while. And then the invitation is just now I can start to examine my thoughts and feelings so that I can make friends with and be compassionate to those parts of myself that are unskillful and unpleasant. Does that make sense? Yeah. So depending on where we are, sometimes we need more concentration and sometimes we can use more awareness. It just depends on where you are. Some days when there's a lot of reactivity, it's better to do a little more concentration to keep yourself settled down. And some days when you're feeling very kind of focused and settled, awareness is very helpful to notice, so what is going on with me now? What is coming up? Because I might discover some... I always think that mindfulness has the opportunity even more than therapy, and I apologize to any therapists who disagree with this, to be able to discover geological places in ourselves. So I think we're like geology, like we have these stratas, and the top strata is the most obvious. Those of us who've been sitting for many, many years, we start to drop down, we start to discover other things about ourselves. Other levels of discomfort or other levels of sort of pure experience. So it becomes more of a geological sense of dropping in, getting to know ourselves a little more deeply. If I don't use awareness, I won't be able to make that geological dig. And get to know myself a little more deeply. Because then we're more able to work with ourselves when we do get triggered, when we do experience threats, right? Whether it's a low-grade threat, could be voicemail, email, someone looking at us, our own mind. It could be bigger threats, a little bit what you were talking about, just delving into the politics of people who, some of whom are violent. If we've gotten to know ourselves really well, we'll be able to manage our way of being in those more challenging situations. Nelson Mandela is one of my heroes, and he spent 27 years in prison, 20 at Robben Island. And every night, he tells the story that he would go and review the day and see how he had done. And it was a kind of a awareness practice to notice what his response was so that he could be more alerted to it the next day and catch it sooner and make more positive changes. Any other questions, thoughts?
I understood a lot of what you said about the posse, but I think you also said it helps you detach from the outcome of your actions, and could you say more about that?
Yes. As we know, attachment is suffering. Preaching to the choir here. And I work in organizations with leaders, and I especially higher level leaders in big organizations, vice presidents, senior vice presidents. They're there because they can tolerate failure and they know how to keep going. Because you don't get to be that level in an organization without being able to manage that. Often when I'm called in to coach someone at that level, it's because they're starting to break down and they're becoming stressed. And the first thing I ask them is, are you attached to the result? If they say yes, I say, well, that's what we need to work on, because it will kill you at the level, because they have, you know, huge amounts of money they're dealing with, huge amounts of responsibility, huge amounts of people. And so Gandhi said, put everything you have into it and don't be attached to the result. Now, this is not an easy thing to do. And it's worthwhile to use our awareness and check ourselves on a daily basis. How attached am I to... you fill in the blank. So having a preference or wishing or hoping something would happen is different than being attached to it. When we're attached, there's that tightening that happens. The sense of critical mind comes up, either towards self or others. And also, attachment often makes us feel separate. I need to make this happen. I need to make it work. I need to have this. So it's an I, ego thing. So the idea is to be alerted to those. And I just remind myself, why, there's a wonderful app. I don't know if you guys know it. Anyway, I like it. It's called We Croak. Isn't it great? 99 cents. And it's very simple. It says a little thing when you open it. It says, in Bhutan, thinking about death 5 times a day brings happiness. And then it sends you 5 death quotes a day. So I also have a centering app that comes with my organization. So when my phone goes, I think, oh, either time to center or I'm going to die. And the reason that I think it's so helpful is because it reminds me of impermanence on a regular basis. I'm like, right. Doesn't last, so I could be appreciative I have this now. My granddaughter's very funny. She's 10 and we've gotten her into it. And she can be a drama queen. And so often my daughter and I would say, look, your time on earth is limited. Is this really how you want to spend it? So if I do say anything, she goes, Nani, remember, you're going to die. Is that how you want to spend your time? Actually, you're right. I don't want to spend my time that way. So whatever way we can use to remind ourselves that impermanence exists and that attachment brings suffering, at the same time, we really need to follow our passion and to, for those of us who are inclined to put ourselves out there and try to contribute. At least that would be my view. How can we contribute? So the way around it for me is, I think, this is what I want to do. instead of I do it, I'm going to invite Mother Teresa's compassion to come through me to help me do it. I'm going to invite the Dalai Lama's wisdom to come through me to help me do this. Sometimes I actually say out loud, okay, Your Holiness, I need you now. This would be the time to give me some insight. And just by saying that and asking that question, it puts my attention here instead of here. Right? Because I'm thinking, I have to get this. There's a tightening that happens around my mind. And if I think, okay, Trungpa Rinpoche or Your Holiness, it makes my attention go like this. And then I have more access to intuition, creativity, innovation, because my mind has opened. It's a trick of the trade to help my mind open. Same with my compassion. When I'm just so annoyed at people's behavior, and all I have to do is look at headlines, I'm like, really? And then I think, Mother. And then I think, oh, everybody there is really trying to be safe. Not very skillfully, unless that's what they're trying to do. And then when I'm feeling less than confident, I invite the founder of Aikido, because Aikido is my background. He was an amazing being, as far as I could tell. I missed him on this planet, but really feel his energy. And all of a sudden I feel like, okay, I'm going to step forward into this. Not Wendy, but I'm going to use that energy to come through me. And if we can feel it viscerally, like that feeling of the breeze coming through our arms, it's very different than I hold my arms out. If we were all to do this for 2 minutes, we would fatigue probably after a minute. If I had that feeling that the breeze comes through me, we could probably all stay twice as long and not fatigue as easily. So that's the principle of how do I find... And the reason I use archetypes instead of just the flow is because the stressors are specific. So she wants that, he said this, they need this. So if I can use specific energies to match that, it helps me move forward much more easily without gripping as much. And I'm not saying I don't get attached, I do. I just try to catch myself using awareness and go, oh, look at me, I can feel myself tightening around the outcome. Of course I want this to happen. And if I can lighten up, open up a little bit, connect to the posse, I still move forward and do the activity to the best of my ability, usually with less effort. A little more, I think it brings resilience. That's an in word these days. That help?
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions or thoughts? Yes.
I want to go back to the first question that this woman up here raised and your response to it. And I probably misheard it completely, but it sounded like at the end you were saying something like, when you get bigger, it draws more projections and that's the price that we pay. I didn't understand what that meant at all.
So when we get bigger, we're more visible, right? We have a bigger energy. So people who have big energies, they don't have to be a big physical person, but they walk in the room and you notice them. Or they sit down and you notice them. That's called having a big energy. They've got a bigger presence around them. That means they're visible. And when we're visible, people will project onto us. They'll imagine we're this way, they'll imagine we're that way. We do that. We all do it. We do it with movie stars. If you ever had a movie star that you've liked, you've projected onto that movie star that, gee, they're wonderful, or gee, they're awful, or gee, they're terrific. One of the reasons I think that we make ourselves small and try to disappear is so that people will not project onto us. Because it's difficult to have people projecting onto us. But people will project. It's the nature of relationships.
So when you say project, are you talking about people having expectations of us?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so I'll use myself as a case in point. So I travel around the world, and I go to India, and I teach them. They're very funny. They have kind of guru syndrome in India. People are just hilarious. And, you know, they're always like, ah. And when they find out that I drink whiskey and I eat meat, it just freaks them out. Completely. Because they project onto me, because I'm a teacher and I have written books and I go and I have a long-term spiritual practice, that of course I'm going to be pure. And then they're just like, oh no, how can that be? I'm like, yeah, well it is. So that's a just a very straightforward example of projections. People will project positively. They'll think we're better than we are. They'll think we're worse than we are. They just do that. And the more visible we are, the more that happens.
And then our temptation is try to fulfill those expectations.
Either that, which is exhausting, or make ourselves small again so people don't see us. If that happens, though, then we don't have a voice. So, for me, the way I work with it is I use the posse. I just figure, well, they're projecting onto me, and I'll just let Mother Teresa handle the projection. Or I'll let the Dalai Lama. And, it, you know, I do. I smile a little bit. I always think going into anything, you know, people are going to project. And then I have this little saying to myself, it'll probably get weird. And then when that does happen, I go, see, it got weird. And it keeps a sense of humor. It makes it a little bit lighter. And I think, I know people will project onto me positively and negatively. And I try to relax with it and just use my posse to sort of absorb it. You know, in Aikido, which is a Japanese martial art that I do, one of the things that, the principles we use is that the person who attacks us, the attack doesn't land on our body, it lands in the space. So you move in such a way or you adjust the dynamic so that the punch or the grab ends up in space with a strike. Does that make sense in terms of martial art? Mm-hmm. So the idea is the projection lands in the space. It doesn't land on me. So if somebody says you're great, it lands in the space. If somebody says, you know, you're terrible, it lands in the space. And I just let it be out there, which gives me a little bit more panoramic view. It's sort of like, did you ever have a friend and you could see they were in relationship but it was going south, but they couldn't see it? You know, we're all sort of like this. You'd say, Wendy, there's a hand on your face, and I would say, I feel something. You can see my hand, I can't see it. We can see each other's hands. When the projection lands in the space, I can see it. If it lands on me, I react to it. Just like in the martial art, if they hit me, I'll tighten up. But if I can move in such a way that the attack lands in the space, I can redirect it. So that's the same principle that we can use with people who say things to us or about us, whether it's critical or not. We can even use it with our own self-critic. We can put that criticism out in the space and look at it and have a little bit more ventilation around it instead of it being so tight inside of us. Does that help? Anything else? So we just have a couple of minutes left. I think it's supposed to end. Yeah. And I'd like to just take you through a little centering practice. And when we're finished, there's some inspiration cards on the table. Some of you know, and you have some. Well, there's a couple of new ones. And if you don't have a bookmark, there's a bookmark with this centering on it. So in this centering practice, we work with the breath as up and down instead of in and out. And so when we inhale, we lengthen up out the top of our heads. And as we exhale, we soften our chest, breathing down, thinking of something that makes us smile. That releases oxytocin. So let's do that one more time. As we inhale, we lengthen our spine, a nice dignified posture. As we exhale, we soften, thinking of something that makes us smile. Now, if you would open your eyes and not hard eyes, but soft eyes, just see if you can sort of push, see a point on the far wall in front of you with your eyes softly. And then imagine your personal space is like a bubble, which it is, and you push it out to reach the wall and then out to the sides and behind you and above you. So your bubble is so big that it surrounds everyone in this room, in this Sangha, together. So that's a sense of being inclusive, that you've expanded your bubble and you've gotten bigger. And now ask yourself, what would it be like if there was just a little more ease in my being? And let yourself wonder. Nice. I'm going to take you through a little bit shorter one. That was about a 20-second one. I'll go over it again, but let's do the shorter one. The shorter one is more like 5 seconds. It's uplift, expand out a little bit, and then soften. And we even have a 1 second centering that was came from a woman I worked with who was a lawyer who was very tight, and I kept working with her with this process, and she said, I can't sustain it. And I said, well, just do a little 5 second burst. And she said, like a lizard push-up. I don't know if you've ever seen lizards when they do this. You can go on YouTube and see them doing it to rock music. So we will rock you. So we call it lizard push-up. It's just, you know, if you've gotten that little bit of tightness or that little sinking, you just go ding. It's like 1 second. So those are our three. The first one is about 20 seconds. I'll go over that again. As we inhale, we lengthen our spine up out the top of our heads toward the sky. As we exhale, we soften our chest, breathing down, thinking of something that makes us smile, releasing oxytocin. And then with our eyes, we see a point on the far wall, and we push our bubble out to that point and then expand it to the sides, behind us, above to the ceiling and below our chairs. And then have a sense that everybody inside this room is inside our personal space, that we're connected together. We're all in each other's bubbles. And then asking ourselves, what would it be like if there was just a little more ease in this moment? And we'll do the shorter one. We'll uplift, expand out, and settle. And we'll do a little lizard push-up, ding. Nice. You can kind of feel the room brighten when everybody goes up like that. And then if we're not careful, there's kind of this ceiling that comes and everything. And so I think we'll have more energy and resilience if we're a little lighter and brighter. And the short one, the three-part one, I have it on my bag and we use it with all of our work. It comes from a Japanese Aikido teacher that I had who was frustrated with us when we were in a seminar. First he said we were too stiff, and then he showed what he wanted, then he said we were too sloppy. His English wasn't great. He was trying to communicate what he was looking for, and he said, I want to see you're noble. I want to see you're awesome. I want to see you're shiny. Which we call NAS. And I've got noble, awesome, shiny on my bag here. So noble is the upliftedness, the dignity. Awesome is the sense of expansiveness. And shiny is the warmth. And I think if we can cultivate a little more noble, awesome, shiny, we might be able to find our way forward with more inspiration and make more of a contribution into the world. So thank you very much for your time and attention. Wishing you many blessings.